Case 52 from the Shoyu Roku, Sozan's Dharmakaya, preface to the assembly. All knowledgeable persons are able to learn by parable and analogy, but when comparisons cannot be made and when it's impossible to find something similar or identical, how can it be expressed? Attention. Sozan asked Toku Joza, Buddha's true Dharmakaya is like the vast sky. Its conforming to things and manifesting shapes is like the moon in the water. How can this principle of conforming be expressed? Toku said, it's like the donkey seeing the well. Sozan remarked, well said, but that's only 80% of it. Toku rejoined, how about you, Osho? Sozan replied, the well sees the donkey. Appreciatory verse. Donkey sees the well sees the donkey. Wisdom contains without exception. Purity permeates more than enough. Behind the elbow, who discerns the sign? Within the house, no books are kept. Loom threads don't hang, a matter of the shuttle. Patterns emerge every which way. The intent differentiates of itself. Today is the sixth day of our training period, the last full day of sitting together. Time goes by sometimes quickly and sometimes slowly, sometimes doesn't go by at all. In any event, whatever it's been doing for you, it's the sixth day. That is an unalterable fact. And tomorrow we have a half a day, and then we go our ways. Once again, I want to remind myself and my excellent friends sitting together that this is a ripe time. Having worked each one of us very hard in our own way to look into the great matter of life and death, to arouse the way-seeking mind and to be with it breath by breath and step by step, and also and to haul ourselves back as we touch and go incessantly, don't we? We touch the moment, or touch to, or engage, and then we're off. And as it says in this appreciatory verse, the intent differentiates of itself. We all share the great intention to be present to our lives, to enter into pure and total presence, unconditioned presence, we could say. In other words, our intention as practitioners of the Buddha Dharma is to be present without condition. In other words, to be the Fudo-myo, the one who sits upright and is unmoving, not in a rigid or fixated way, but the one who is willing, both willing and also determined to be with, and more than be with, to participate, to enter into what's going on as our way of growing in love and understanding, as a way of becoming more mature in our lives, and also being free of a certain kind of freer, I should say, since the world is on fire with suffering. And even though we all have times when we're free of our own self-clinging, we are reminded of through this activity of Dharma, this paticca-samuppada, this co-creation that we make with all the many beings, dependent origination. We are enmeshed and engaged with the many, many beings, and so even though we have times when we're quite free here in this abiding in this great spaciousness of no coming or going, we also are feel the great fire that is consuming our planet, and so it's there, isn't it? But in any event, we are here this last day, and boy, what a for me, no greater challenge or greater blessing than to be able to do this with a few good friends, and also no greater blessing and challenge to do it in such an intimate, friendly, homey environment. We are, as we sit down with friends, we're all wayfarers and yogis, and we are doing it in this kind of, coming together in this kind of environment. We're free of a certain politic of organization. Always an organization and always a container, but we are, I suppose we wouldn't be here, each one of us, if we didn't have some ambivalence about belonging. I think that each one of us, some of us are more on the side of the belonging and more on the side of the less of the belonging, but I think we all, well, I'll speak for myself. My life has been one of a great tension between wishing to have compatriots along the way, good friends along the way, and to belong to a band of the few, the proud, the, you know what I mean, the longing we all have to do something authentically and to be associated with people who have some ideal. I mean, you know, maybe that's not a good thing, we're not supposed to say that, but I do think as practitioners we all have ideals, and we all are trying to enact those ideals, and hopefully the ideals are pretty close to something that's true and alive and juicy in our life, that's true, not false, unconditionally so, and that unconditionally so-ness is the compass setting or the model through which we, in a sense, set our compass setting and organize our lives. But we all, I would say, have this ambivalence between belonging and being independent. In the chanting book, it says, be a light unto yourself. The Buddha, in his original teaching, encouraged us, rely on yourself, rely only on yourself, be a light unto yourself. This is, from the Zen perspective, quite a profound message, to be a light unto yourself. What self is the Buddha talking about anyway? Is there a self that is independent or separate from the other many manifestations in this moment? And yet we all have this tension, or I certainly feel it. You know, it's interesting, I feel it all the time, or so much of the time, this tension between connection and involvement and friendship and sangha relations, and the longing for wildness, and the longing to be alone, and the longing to be a true renegade. James Ford called me a renegade in his book, I think. I thought, I practice zazen, if that's what it means to be a renegade. leaving aside my own prickliness about being called, being given titles, I actually secretly quite proud of and having been a member of the army for many years, having you know, come up through the ranks in the army, in the Zen Center, from you know, being the butcher, the baker, all of the positions, you know, that's something rare and hard to conceive of me, as the treasurer of the community or the secretary. But anyway, so I have, it's not that I haven't tried, but in my 20 years of, and then at the Buddhist Association, also a sangha and a community, and now living by myself and coming and sitting just with friends. And but the point is that I think we all, each one of us has we all are independent cusses, each one of us in our own quirky way, and yet at the same time we all share this great love of practice and dharma. We all want to be free of self-clinging and free to delve into this great matter in our own way, and we also need discipline and containment and friendship in order to do it. So I am feeling, in being here with like-minded spirits a great sense of gratitude and appreciation. And I feel, and I'm sure you do, the support of each one of us. And yet that there's also this great space and freedom, and we come together and support ourselves, and then we disperse into our lives, and then we come back, or we write a letter, or make a phone call, or we do what we do. But and I also think that in this tension between this a soft spot or tension between freedom and solidity, perhaps, might be a way of talking about it. Stability, a discipline, one-pointedness of mind, rigor, vigor. There is that a need. We all have that, and we all recognize that if we don't tame our donkey, that donkey will have his day with us. That donkey will take us off into into the poison ivy patch, into the briars, and make incredible mischief. And that donkey will convince us that it's a commendable idea to be your worst self. That's another thing, isn't it? Without the discipline, without the stability, both the stability and openness, we could say wildness, freedom. But without the stability and without the tenderness, the tender soft spot that is the tension between, or the soft spot between, our longing for to open the hand of thought and to fly free, be free of self-clinging and free of consensus gentium and free of the this stream of vulgarity that is so much of human life. We all to open and to expand into this vast sky of the Dharmakaya, and to fly free, or to swim free, or to run free, or to walk slowly free, or to hobble. And at the same time, we know, for me, I see in sitting here the increasing need for the discipline of Zazen in order to actually really experience it and not just be hoodwinked by my own donkey. So I've been appreciating that and reflecting on it with this koan, and appreciating us, each one of us. I suppose on the one hand, there's no greater longing of the heart than to belong to something. And I think that the deepest part of that belonging, and also our certain ambivalence about what it means to belong, and whether we'll sell our soul out or whether we'll be domesticated in our community, or in our marriage, or in our the things of our life that we commit to, that we we don't want that to happen. At the same time, we find ourselves in relationship, inexorably drawn. I go for a walk and I say, wow, it's really great to be out of the Zendo. I'll just do a little jogging out here in the field, or go for a nice walk through the forest, and then I find myself, and I expand out into it, and it's quite wonderful. And then I find myself drawn back to this, to my mat, and to my friends. It's interesting, isn't it? And then I expand out, and I'm drawn back. So here we are. And I was thinking about the intelligence of reflecting on the intelligence of belonging, and this tension between being overwhelmed by, engulfed, overwhelmed, and my own personal terror of my own sort of claustrophobia, and love of wild places and high places and deep places and ocean places and fast running and fast motorcycles and certain, we might say from one model, a certain love of intensity, which has its own problems, and on the other side, the need for stability and focus and so forth. Anyway, belonging is an interesting thing, isn't it? And the teaching of what we've been studying in the teaching of a self-realization practice from this Zen perspective of self-fulfilling samadhi, practice that is a self-fulfilling engagement, and that we find fulfillment in being present to truth. We all being present to truth and being more than present, but being willing to enter into or be intimate with that aliveness, and in that engagement with that aliveness to find a joy and a freedom and a spaciousness and a love that is beyond understanding and all comprehension. So I suppose we are wise to both want to belong and wary of the price of belonging, and also have to ask ourselves sternly and vigorously, what is it that you really want to belong to? And what is that? I think in the deepest sense, the belonging is the wish to belong to the source of creation, belong to or dissolve into the source of the aliveness of the moment. We all long to go home. We all long to be free of samsara. I know in Zen we're supposed to, on the one hand, not value nirvana over samsara, but I actually am more of an arhat, I think, bodhisattva, if I'm really honest. I really long for freedom. I really long to be done with myself and my endless checking and my pettiness and small-mindedness and my reactivity. And I know that pettiness and small-mindedness and reactivity is the curriculum. But I'm quite determined to approach it with a great deal of caution, and not to pretend, but to approach it with great caution, born of the discipline of this practice of Zazen, and also to honor that more than anything in the world, I want to enter the stream of life and be free of self-clinging. We want that. To enter, to be a true stream entrant, one who enters into this unconditional movement or simultaneous arising and passing away of this great loving, intelligent brightness that can manifest anywhere. It permeates, what does it say? It's quite beautiful. Purity permeates more than enough. And when you look at the history of Zen study, which is lots of different experiments over the years, but certainly one of the great movements in the Buddhist tradition is the Yogacara movement, which was second century. I'm studying the Yogacara Sutra now with a friend on the mountain called the Sandi Nirmochana, and basically teaching of this school, which is one of the main streams that has informed Zen practice. Started with the Vasubandhu brothers. The Vasubandhu brothers, you know, sound like a rock band. The Vasubandhu brothers. But basically what the teaching was that permeated this experiential contemplative tradition. Of course, there's the intellectual side, but from the practice traditions, the living experience of what it means to be intimate in aliveness is the study. And then, of course, there's lots of teachings about it, but they are descriptions of the study. But this way of practice and this school that was founded in India at this time, a great both university and practice center that attracted yogis, practitioners, both scholars and yogis, and scholar yogis and yogi scholars. And a fundamental teaching was that we are all of one dough, of one taste, that all of experience and all of phenomena is of one taste. And if we are willing to that it's all consciousness, it's all the manifestation. That was the fundamental, one of the core teachings of this Yogacara school. And there are lots of proliferations of it, but the fundamental message you get if you study some of these teachings, which are, well, I have an appetite for it, but I have an appetite for study, is that we are one body, that it is one mind, one consciousness, and there is nothing that's not the manifestation of this consciousness. Sansan used to say, we're like cookies, you know. So we're like a Christmas cookies, you know, little trees stamped out of the dough, all the different, sweet metaphor and also quite profound, of one taste or of a common denominator, that all of creation has the common denominator of zero. Zero. That we all have a common denominator. And then what we forget, our common denominator, experientially, we enter the world of alienation and doubt, and we no longer belong to the family of the Buddha or the family of creation. We are outsiders. And this belonging, of course, is not dependent upon where we hang our hat, whether we hang our hat in the forest, in a little cabin, or we hang our hat with a great community, or we hang our hat as lay people, or whatever we do, teachers or therapists or so forth. And so we all have this great longing of the human heart, and we manifest that longing in different ways and get in trouble in different ways. So that's quite a story, isn't it, of itself. And we also have the great wish to be free and to be independent and to accomplish our own independent, wonderful way and so forth. The donkey sees the well sees the donkey. Wisdom contains without exception, purity permeates. Purity permeates more than enough. we chant Om Nam in this, and as a practice, or as a giving voice to this practice of self-fulfilling samadhi, or self-gazing upon itself, self-coming to know itself in the form of self-forgetting itself in the activity of itself. Of course, it's tricky when you look in the pond and mirror, mirror, who, on the wall, who's the most beautiful of them all? It's not a narcissistic practice, although it's a kind of big narcissism, isn't it? But in order to enter this big narcissism or belong, right, so that you really get that there's nothing but you in this vast Dharma Dhatu, it's all a manifestation of your own self nature, you've got to sweat white beads and do some serious ass training. You've got to really hunker down, and you have to be quite disciplined in this practice of upright sitting and giving yourself to the posture and pure and uncontrived presence. And total devotion to that which is unknowable and ungraspable, and in doing that, when we do that, when we enter this great master's furnace, the cauldron, the pressure cooker here, sometimes pressure cooker, sometimes freedom, but let's face it, this is sometimes no walk in the park. It deconstructs you and just put your bullshit right in your face, doesn't it? I mean, just put your story bullshit, your defense. I don't mean you as opposed to me. I am quite, you know, sometimes I, you know, go out and hide. It's quite embarrassing. Oh dear. I get, my intent gets differentiated when I, you know, start to, you know, all right, here's a bad joke. Since I'm totally differentiated right now, my intent is becoming, the donkey walks into a bar and orders a beer. The bartender says, so, why the long face? Purity permeates more than enough. Wisdom contains without exception. We chant. In this regard, in terms of the great leveling that takes place and the grinding down and polishing and being deconstructed and unconditioned, we get, you know, we're in the washer and the tumbler and the dryer and the, you know, and the blender, and we willingly enter into that because we that want to be free. And, we chant in the evening, Om Nam. Every evening, David leads us in chanting. Actually, for me, one of the high points of the retreat is the early morning reading and the evening chanting. I don't know. But it's probably because I get to hand the baton off to this guy and say, well, you... And then and it's such a relief and such a joy to have such good friends in the Dharma, such excellent friends, and to have an excellent friend in my Dharma brother, David, that I come in and I run in, hand him the baton, and then he runs off wherever he's going to run to. But it's one of the, for me anyway, the high, the joy of the retreats, to listen to and catch his wind in my sails and go with him and say, I don't know where you're going, but I'm going with you wherever it is. That's a wonderful thing, isn't it? So we chant, and I always get flirted one of those readings from the guy Hongzhi, who to me is like a manifestation of an incomparable sage. I mean, wow, he just makes me cry. It makes me cry when I listen to him, and inspires me and humbles me, and all of that. But so I set sail with that, and it's a wonderful thing. And different pieces of what he says flirt with me, you know, flirt, you know, like they're like a beautiful being, and they flirt, and I have a flirtation with them. My major flirtation this morning in the silence and in the beauty and pristineness of the Zendo in the morning was the last line, which said, and so what is this? And I thought, indeed. Indeed, that's the koan, isn't it? What is this? Wow, what is this? Oh, what is this? Oh, what is this? Oh, what is this? Yeah, amen. Can I get an amen? Amen. Then the other, oftentimes the other high part for me of the is evening. Chanting and reading somehow very ripe, and I set sail with the Om Nam. Om Nam is the mantra of the universe in its purity. Purity permeates more than enough. That's our wisdom contains without exception. No exception. No exception to prajna. Nothing but prajna and upaya, the skillful presentation of this immense a brightness. Nothing but, that's what this is we're singing about, nothing but this wisdom contains without exception. Purity permeates more than enough. Om Nam in the Korean Zen tradition, wonderful, one of the wonderful streams of this Zen tradition. And we all have been this combination of cranky and unusual individuals, but also great yogis, practitioners, and seekers of truth. We all fit quite wonderfully in our own unfitting way in this tradition. Zen is filled with people like you and me. They wouldn't have me in any other tradition. I was talking with Ralph the other day, and he said, you know what? I said, you know, Ralph, you're sort of a Hinayana kind of a guy. You're always studying these, you know, these sutras that I can't pronounce. I said, you know, like the I myself actually have quite a fondness of the early sutras. And I said, why don't you join I shouldn't say Hinayana. That's a swear word. The Theravadins. Or the wisdom of the elders, and he said they wouldn't have me. I thought, well, that's pretty much like me. Thank you. And anyway, purity permeate. We chant Om Nam. Om means is from a long teaching in the Korean tradition. The mantra is part of a sutra that's chanted that we used to chant all the time. In Korean, but Om is it's called the universe and the purity. I used to, the mantra of the one pure and clear thing. So we are inviting, when we chant Om Nam, we are calling out to the universe, as David reminds us, since all of life is a kind of call and response. Actually, and as you get intimate, the calling and the responding is just one unimaginable thing, but we call to the universe. I call out, sometimes I cry quite imploringly. In the midst of water, I find myself crying out, however we cry, however we manifest our one true nature in the moment, however we breathe life into the chant, breathe our own aliveness into the chant, we call Om Nam. And the teaching of Om Nam and the meaning of Om Nam, it's the mantra of the universe in its purity, or the mantra of the one pure and clear thing. And the understanding, the understanding of pure and clear is actually very important to the understanding of this teaching that we've been studying, this relational teaching, this self-fulfilling samadhi, this self-actualizing, self-realizing practice that we, this movement that we do, or we engage in. So the universe in its purity, and the one pure and clear thing, is not pure as opposed to impure. So Zen, this Bodhisattva tradition is not a saintly tradition. It's a sagely tradition. And the difference, not that one is good or bad, there are different flavors, I suppose, but the sagely tradition recognizes that its purity is found in purely this. That's the one, how you taste the one taste of the Yogacara, or the one taste of the mind only, or consciousness only, or Dharmakaya only school, is that you dare to be only this, not lost in this, but upright in the very center of this, to find release, to find self-realization, or find freedom. So it's purely this, and the one clear thing is when you're purely this, you're outside of time. So clear and pure from the Yogacara and from the Zen tradition is the intention to and the experience of being purely this. And when you're purely this, you are outside of time and all that goes with time. A lot goes with time, doesn't it? A lot goes with time. I'll do it tomorrow. I'll wait when David rings the bell. I'll just procrastinate for a moment before I come in. Someone asked Yamada Roshi, what's enlightenment? He says, get up when your alarm rings. Period. I have a little 5 or 6 minutes here. I have a little window of opportunity to chill out. Anyway, one pure and clear means clear in the sense of clearly timeless, clearly unimpeded, clearly attention. Buddha's true Dharmakaya is like vast sky, it can conforming to things and manifesting shape, and permeates more than enough. That's a nice Zen way of saying that. Well, the loom threads don't hang still. Loom, a functional loom does not tarry, it doesn't stay still, it doesn't hang out, it doesn't stop, it doesn't tarry. It's a matter of the shuttle. The patterns emerge every which way. The word for loom means is the word for kinhin, and the word for loom, shuttle, are all the same thing in the Chinese tradition. And the word of this word ji, meaning the activity of weaving, or the activity of touching. Also, kinhin is the same root. The activity of something that is an activity that is both a horizontal, like a walking in the garden and going somewhere on the horizontal, and simultaneously a depth and a stability, right? Something that is entering out into something that is big and vast and wide and timeless, but also in the center of that there is this touching and being touched place by this stability of practice, this upright posture, this depth, this commitment to be the one who doesn't move, who is unconditionally present, and that present or that silence or whatever you want to call it, or whatever resonates with you, meets its particularness, and we call that Kin Hin, we call that the great activity of the loom.